So the first question that I'm sort of asking folks is sort of, how do you identify yourself? How do you situate yourself within radical movements? And if you can talk like a brief history of how you came to be involved in like the Indigenous People Solidarity Movement and other groups you're involved in right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess identifying myself just like white male, kind of coming from a privileged background, I guess, kind of like mid-upper class. And not really getting involved in any kind of activism until I was about 23 years old. No, probably a bit younger, but around then. So not like when I was a teenager or anything. I think kind of like two things that really like kind of opened my eyes, I guess, was like hip-hop culture and also Adbusters magazine. So those were things that like when I was a teenager I was reading or listening to, but not really being socially justice activist type of thing. And then what happened was I went to Queen's University for a year of teacher's college and took a teaching for social justice class, and that kind of like was more of a formal introduction to oppression and privilege and injustice. Because I was taking math at university, so it wasn't really... I think I really like that, because it's more about problem-solving and logical thinking and that kind of thing, which are transferable skills. And I interviewed Ward Churchill, and he said that like most systems of education are indoctrination, so they teach you what to think, and I think that's something I agree with. So I think I'm glad that I didn't go to university to learn how to think about injustice. I mean... I think it was better to develop it kind of informally and in community and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, so I was at Queen's for the year. I led like a workshop on access to education, and that was in 2000. And then also at the same time, I got started writing for the student newspaper. I was on the track team, and we needed someone to write articles about our meets, so I started writing. And then I went back to Waterloo to end my original degree, and started writing about other stuff for the student newspaper. So I got involved through that, just what was going on campus in terms of things I was interested in. Like I did I edited a Buy Nothing Day feature, wrote a thing about like Anti-Car Day or whatever it was, and with the Buy Nothing Day feature, got involved with a media activism group at WPIRG, the Waterloo Public Interest Research Group. So that was kind of that's how I got involved in activist stuff. It was actually like getting into that group, and we got we started the Independent Media Center in Kitchener-Waterloo, which was also the base for the Ontario Indie Media site. So I was doing media stuff for both the student newspaper and indie media stuff, and organizing in this group called Media Watch. And I was just writing about whatever I was interested in, like some kind of like social justice stuff, some art stuff, some whatever was going on. But some of the stuff that I covered, the first thing was a talk by some Christian Peacemaker Team people who'd been at Burnt Church, and WPIRG put on this talk, and they invited the student newspaper to cover it, so I went. That was my first Aboriginal event that I attended. And it wasn't even an Aboriginal event because it was allies talking about it. And then Ward Churchill came to talk. I got to interview him before the talk. And that was kind of eye-opening, and I think he had some good things to say. And I think really just like picking stuff up along the way and kind of like gradually informing my thinking. He was big on like knowing your history, knowing how we got to this point so we can understand what we can do about it. That was early 2000s, and then I left Waterloo, came to Ottawa, was kind of in and out of activism for a while, and in 2008 I was doing media stuff again, 2007, 2008, and kind of getting more involved in the community again about what was going on locally in terms of activism or social justice. And there was a call, I guess also through the media, I got involved with Lynchpin, which is a newspaper of Common Cause, which is an Ontario anarchist group. And there was a few events that were called anarchist assemblies here in Ottawa, and at one point someone from Common Cause came down, introduced what they were doing. They were based in Toronto and Hamilton at the time. There was actually some people from Ireland came over and really got us started. And they were part of the, I think it's called the Workers' Solidarity Movement over in Ottawa, or over in Ireland. But anyway, so I got involved in Common Cause, and I remember the first thing I heard about Barrier Lake, I think they, maybe the Solidarity Group or whatever, they sent us a message, and it was like in March of 2008, I think it was, and that was when there was like a coup on the reserve where the government was deposing their traditional council and putting in a new chief and council. And there was protests in the community, and the SQ was like escorting this new chief and council onto the reserve against community pressure. So anyways, that was the first I heard of Barrier Lake. And then I guess it was kind of a couple months later, the community was coming to Ottawa to put pressure on the government. So I think there were six of us. We didn't have a group going, but there were just six of us got together to support those actions. And there was a few actions over the summer where community members would come from Barrier Lake. Barrier Lake's situated 4 hours, 3.5, 4 hours north of here in Quebec in the La Vérendrye Reserve Park. And so we were doing organizing support around them coming to Ottawa to do protests. And kind of, I guess, in the fall, we decided we'd like to form a group that would be able to support Barrier Lake on an ongoing basis, but also do other Indigenous solidarity work. And so we were having some meetings, and we were getting like 15, 20 people. And it so happened that there was a group already called IPSMO, Indigenous People Solidarity Movement Ottawa, that was an action group of Oprah Carleton. And some were students, some weren't. It had been going, I think, for a couple of years. But the thing was that I guess people had been away over the summer, so no one of the IPSMO group had been involved over the summer with the Barrier Lake stuff. But when we started having these meetings to form a group, then some of those people came, and we were just trying to figure out what name we should have for this new group, and we figured that IPSMO sounded good. So it was kind of like we formed a new group that was kind of continuing what they were doing, but different at the same time. It was more like more community-based and less on campus, but it's still like we still are an action group of Oprah Carleton to this day, as well as Oprah Ottawa. That's how I got involved, I guess, in what I'm doing now, and continuing to do media stuff as well, covering issues for Rabble or the Dominion,
And so one of the questions I sort of try and follow up with when I'm talking to folks is sort of like, it's always really fascinating to hear sort of some of the ideas or experiences or traditions or practices that you you take on in sort of your day-to-day organizing work that really influences your understanding of what it means to work in solidarity with Indigenous struggles. And I'm wondering if you want to talk a little bit about sort of what ideas or experiences or traditions that you sort of rely on to help you negotiating with that, or if there is any.
I don't know what you mean by traditions.
So, it's a good question. So, I'm thinking sort of like, so in the example I was giving you earlier, sort of when people were talking about how they come out of sort of a witch tradition, or some people come out of sort of Irish Republican tradition, right?
Yeah.
Other people, you know, sort of just work in terms of different principles, so like some anarchist groups work on, you know, self-determination and autonomy and stuff, and that really resonates with how they work with other people.
Yeah.
And so, but it could be just as simple as different ideas or experiences or things that you are interested in that you try and practice in your day-to-day life that help you through that.
Yeah. I guess, really I got into it through communication. trying to raise awareness and get the word out about things, and that's still really like a principle of what I do, and I think what our group does as well. And I, like I was saying before, with Ward Churchill, just pick up a few things there. Every time I'd go to an event or something, just pick up some ideas that kind of shape how I view what solidarity is, or what Aboriginal culture is, or like what we're fighting for.
And what would you say are some of those ideas?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, like, one thing that stands out is this workshop with Herb Joseph, who's from Six Nations, and that was in Hamilton. And I think, first off, it was like, it was called Anna's Village. It was an anarchist conference. And I was presenting there on media with the Independent Media Center and with the Hamilton Independent Media Center. And they just had a thing saying, suggest other workshops you'd like to see. And I said, well, like, that was where I started attending some Aboriginal events in KW. At some point, I'm not sure exactly where this fits in, but I was taking a course in Ojibwe language. But I just suggested they should have a Native workshop. And I think that was why they ended up having Herb Joseph there. And what he was talking about a couple things. And just like, I think, like, he gave some history about just, like, what had gone on and stuff, but I think he was saying, like, the importance of non-Native people standing up in partnership with Native people has made, like, a lot of difference. And especially, I think, when Native people were so disenfranchised, so knowing that history, that it's been collective efforts that have done stuff. There's like a lot of kind of like different ideas I picked up here and there that I don't really can't put a finger on.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So I mean, sort of building into the second theme. So, the sort of big thing I want to get through in this project is really for us to start to talk about what decolonization actually means, right?
Yeah.
So the word is used in a whole bunch of different contexts to mean different things. And so I've been asking each person for, how do you personally understand decolonization? How is that maybe practiced in your collectives or the organizations you work with?
Yeah, I think in terms of how we work as a group, it's very much like, there's kind of like three different, I guess you could call them pillars that we kind of like try and organize around, which is, one is providing direct support to Indigenous struggles, efforts, whatever. And that's been like with Barrier Lake, especially over the last few years. But it's kind of like taking leadership, providing whatever kind of support we can offer, whether it's communications, whether it's fundraising, whether it's like going to protests, rallies, coordinating other people to go. So like what, however we can support what people are already doing, what communities are already doing. And then also the second thing I think, is that we kind of recognize the need, for education, both of ourselves, but also of the general non-Native population. And that's something that I think, shouldn't be left to Native people to have to educate everyone about everything. So I think that's a role that we have identified as important and take on. And the third thing is we recognize that it's important to build relationships between the people we work with and try to work on that on an ongoing basis, and know that it's not just about whatever like immediate efforts, but actually like trying to develop things over a long term that we just get to know people better. Yeah.
And I think when you're talking about sort of long-standing relationships and these type of things, I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about what the role of relationship building is in decolonization for you.
Yeah. I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the role of community in relationships and how it seems that our, like, communities are really fractured things and really more, it's more like personal networks, it seems, than actually, like, being in community. I was just at a conference yesterday, and it just, like, it was on mental health, and we were talking about, like, really good points and about intersectionality and, like, But the thing was that it was all these people. I knew a few of them, but most of them I'd never seen before, and I might never see again. And I think it's just if you can actually like be in spaces. So like I was thinking about that in terms of community as a geographical place. If you're actually like seeing people on a day-to-day basis, what kind of relationships you can have there. Where there's space to grow and develop understandings of what's important to people and how they understand the world and how you can share your own perspective of the world and you can learn from other people. Whereas, and it seems with activism, it is very much based around, like, we have to do this thing, so we don't really focus on the relationships. But I think, I don't know, like, Facebook seems a cool way just to stay connected with people and just have that ongoing on again, off again conversations and just, yeah. So, I mean, I think we need better things in Facebook, but especially when we're not even in the same city. It's hard to have good relationships. And so I think it's something we've identified as important. I don't know how good we're doing at it, but it's definitely something to reflect on. And yeah.
And what do you see as sort of the outcomes of processes? Doing all this type of work, and what are you hoping will come out of it?
Yeah, I think, well, and you've got another question about, like, what's the state role, and, but it seems like it's very much a personal, you start personally, and you, like, because you're always interacting with all these different people every day, who are on different wavelengths and whatever, so I think it's really important to center it figuring out for yourself how to approach the world, and not relying on like systemic change as something that's going to be the thing that solves things. So like having like, yeah, knowing for yourself what's a process of decolonization and how do you change how you think or how you see the world, and then also having space to share that. I was thinking, actually, like, it's very much, why I'm focusing on the individual thing is because we don't have, like, for lack of a better word, like a school that accredits you in knowing what decolonization is. It's kind of something you have to figure out for yourself and figure out with people, other people who are interested. And it's very, like, ad hoc, and everyone is going to come at it, like, enter through different ways and build different understandings. And, so it's a mix of understanding it for yourself and looking into things that interest you, and also trying to build collective knowledge, and whether it's personal or impersonal, like looking at stuff online and trying to articulate stuff, and so we can see how each other are thinking, even if we don't know each other. But I think also building institutions. I know that a conference I was at in Kitchener-Waterloo is called From the Ground Up. It was 2002 and 2003, about building healthy communities. And I guess this has probably been said elsewhere too, but it's like you can kind of confront the system and try and change the system, or you can build alternatives, like new things that will gradually outgrow the old problematic things. So I think having a focus on building new structures and new institutions and new things that can actually embody some values that are different than this colonial thing. And I think personally, I look at it as like it's kind of like a dominator culture, and and it's global, right? So it's like there's so many different cultures that all kind of get stomped on in different ways, but in the same way as well. And I found, like, I was thinking about this, that just with, like, the residential schools thing, and I was reading, I think the guy's name was Rupert Ross, I'm not sure, but a lawyer who worked up north in Aboriginal communities and had written about just what he learned, and just talking about, like, the difference in culture, and very much, like, I don't know if I'm remembering this totally right, and it's kind of like a stereotype, but it's also an insight into, like, a different cultural way of dealing with things, is that if there's, like, painful experiences, you don't necessarily want to talk about them or focus on them. And I think with the residential schools, like, people don't talk about it. Some survivors just don't want to go there. And then you can run up against a culture that says you have to focus on everything that's bad and clear it out and whatever. And there's just to know there's different cultural ways to deal with things. And so just we're brought up in one way, and it's pretty messed up, but we kind of accept it as normal. And just this is just an example of there's different cultures and different ways of dealing with things and living, and just to impose, like, how we think things should be dealt with is not necessarily helpful. Yeah.
I think you're actually touching on some of the questions I had for the third theme, which I have this hunch, right, and you're sort of echoing it in what you're saying about the fact that I think one of the things that we're really struggling with is this idea that there are these ideas and desires and principles that really affect the way we do work, and that really allow us sort of to think about what type of alternatives we want to create and why. And they have a huge effect on the practices that we engage in. So how we engage as radicals with other communities is sort of influenced by these ideas and desires and principles. And so the sort of the third set of questions that I have sort of relate to those practices. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about maybe some of the ideas and desires and principles that sort of affect how you engage in politics and engage in the world, at least.
Yeah, yeah. I think something I've picked up is, like, from a number of places, is about the role of healing. And I think, I don't know if it's especially true in activism, it's probably true everywhere, but, like, people have all these wounds and act them out and maybe think they can change everything outside of themselves and that will solve problems, whereas really, like, we have to understand that we're living, like, I don't know, maybe people always have emotional wounds or whatever kind of wounds, but really that's an important thing to focus on, is healing, however you do that. So that's one kind of principle, I think. Was it principles and desires and something else? Ideas, yeah. And I think also it's like when you look at colonialism in Canada, it's obviously associated with Europe, and that, like, European people came here and colonized. And I think looking at, like I was saying before, the importance of understanding history, and you look at and I mean really the two kind of most important or most telling ways I got this information, or I picked it up at least, was through John Trudell and Starhawk, just about the importance of the whole burning times in Europe. And that was like this huge colonization of tribes of Europe. And over like dozens, or not dozens, but like many generations of people living in this time where if you don't conform to what is being pushed upon you, you get burned, especially women. And so, like I was talking about healing and wounds, and it, like John Trudell just puts it, like, you're just like this whole mindset, and it's like based on religion. But these people whose ancestors went through that and who now have a new way of living because of that history end up coming here, and the same thing happens again, and these, like, it's this whole, like, societal wounding. And so they, like, kind of trace it back, and to understand what there was before that. There was, like, paganism, there was maybe, like, Wiccanism or whatever. And that, yeah, so I'm not sure where I was going with that, but it's just, like, I think it's a helpful thing to include in our understanding of colonialism. And then also I saw there was an article by someone who had talked about their position as a Muslim person living in Canada, how they approach colonialism, and they were talking about whatever. But then someone, a comment was just that, like, yeah, like, Muslim culture was actually pretty colonial too, and did all this stuff. And it's just, but they didn't do it here, so you might forget about it. But it's like, I guess where I was going with this is to understand, like, it's not like, it's understanding humanity and understanding that there's a reason why these things are happening, and to not, like, really not blame people so much, like, kind of have this empathy. Yeah.
I think, I mean, you're touching, to me, on some important discussions about, for instance, like, what I've been talking about, it, how I've been talking about saying sort of, like, ways of being or ways of relating to each other that exist sort of outside of the logics of capitalism, right, that existed, probably that have always existed and continue to exist, but get suppressed sort of in sort of the way capitalism affects the way we behave towards each other. And so sort of what you were talking about in terms of, you know, relating to people earlier in our conversation has a lot to do, capitalism has a lot to do how, you know, we relate to people, whether we see them as instrumental to our own success or whether we see them as sort of a fellow human, right? And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about, there, you know, I think one of the big criticisms of a lot of our movements is this idea that these ways of thinking are in some way ideological or utopian, that they're like, that we're dreaming of a world that will never actually exist, or that we're setting the bar so high that, you know, it'll never actually come true. I'm wondering if how you would respond to those criticisms when people sort of say that kind of stuff in terms of being like, oh, you're against utopia or you're being ideological about this.
Yeah. I would say those are definitely different things.
Yeah.
Utopianism, like, we can do a lot better than we're doing now, so we might as well work towards that. Whether we, like, and to have an idea of exactly what it's going to look like, I don't think we can know. But ideological, I think that, I've seen some criticisms of, like, dogmatism or whatever, and I think that's very true. I was just reading a thing about how our society might, like, really fall apart in the next while, however long that is. And how the really important thing is going to be what people do at a local level to build things that are alternatives to this really crushing system. And what they were saying was just, it's just like, there are already all these positive local examples at work. Whereas a big problem is that we often have this ideology that this is how things should be done, even if it's not tested. Even if it's not going to work, maybe. We don't know if it's going to work. But if there's actually, like, things that work on a small scale, we can use those things because they're proven, kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So, I think just believing in theory, divorced from experience, isn't great. But I think utopianism is more about, like, having principles or values that you act from, as opposed to Yeah, so that's how I see a difference. And like I said, I think we can do a lot to improve the way the world is. So, yeah.
And so I guess that sort of leads into the final question I've been asking in that section, which is, what do you think the role of imagination is in our movements and in these processes of decolonization? How does imagination play a role in that?
Yeah, I think it's really huge. Like, just because we've been raised in this limited way of thinking, and so to challenge how we see things, and to see other dimensions of things, I think is important. I think when you have this imposed religion and spiritual way of looking at things versus these really time-tested spiritual traditions that are based on nature, and based on a totally different way of understanding things. If you can't use your imagination to move beyond kind of what you've been raised in, then we don't have a whole lot of hope probably to go anywhere really good. It's unlearning, but it's also just being open, I guess, to what might be true. Yeah.
So let's pause there.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess to jump back to how I identify, something I thought of is I did this Myers-Briggs personality test, and I got, I think it was INFP, but whatever it was, I remember a person who did it said I was the exact opposite of what's dominant in our society. So I think maybe there's a more built-in empathy to understanding different ways of being and understanding that if you don't fit in and how that is. It also made me think of something that I heard once, and it was when people are really involved in activism and doing a lot of stuff, kind of the regular person says, so how can I be involved but not how you do it? What can regular people do? And I think it's important, because to understand that perspective is that it's not just people who are really involved and really active. It's really, you've got to look at a broad understanding of where people are at and how people can be involved in this process. And whether that's through psychology or whether that's just through being having different definitions of what inclusive means, I think that's important. And just there's a neighborhood kid that was just walking by when I was having a smoke a few days ago, and I was just asked, she had her school book with her, and I asked her what was in it, and it ended up she was going to study with a friend on for a test on Aboriginal people. So I was able to just give her two copies of my booklet, one for her, one for her friend. And just and that also made me think, though, that I think a lot of times people look as Aboriginal people as other and not part of us, and kind of living out there, maybe on reserves or whatever, not understanding that they're just people like us, living in the same city, having a lot of the same experiences, but also different experiences. I remember going back to Herb Joseph, he was talking about just spirit doesn't see your color. And, but I think identity, a good understanding that I got, it's not when you talk about identity politics, it's not about really your identity, it's about your lived experiences and how that's shaped by whatever group you might be put in. So understanding there are these different experiences, but they were still all kind of the same as well. Yeah. And I was thinking also to not fetishize confrontational approaches. I think in activism, it's a lot of it is based on we have to resist, we have to fight. But I know particularly Grandfather William Kananda was a spiritual elder of the Algonquin people and like a spiritual leader, and his big thing was on forgiveness and just like maybe even just almost like turning the other cheek kind of thing, but really kind of like recognizing people as people and not forcing things on people, but just kind of like walking a good path and things will change. Still like doing things right and working for a better way, but just not that whole, I think it's maybe like the whole fighting thing is, and Judy Rebick had a good piece talking about Isle of Namur and the future of feminism, is that this is like a new way of like, it's not necessarily so confrontational, because you can often get caught up in that whole same dominator behavior pattern, and then you're not really changing things. So just understanding there are different approaches, and I think like reconciliation when you're talking about, because all these like really bad things have happened and are still happening, it's like how do we reconcile that with creating a better way forward? And the state doesn't represent people, and you can understand where some people are coming from, just not knowing, or really feeling disempowered and taking out that frustration on this group they see as other, which is more easier than just understanding their own position as being disempowered and dealing with that themselves. Yeah. And another thing, I think, when you're looking at culture, like, I was just talking to someone about the, there was an Earth First gathering somewhere in the States recently, and a major focus of it was on especially tar sands, but more broadly indigenous. Yeah. And he was saying, like, the major thing, or one major thing there, was that it was actually a dry event. There was no alcohol. And this is coming from an Earth First culture that's very much based around drinking, a drinking culture, and maybe drugs, I don't know. But just like having that respect that maybe we have to change our social ways of being. Because I mean, like, alcohol is kind of just like this really accepted way of being social with people. And the impact it's had on Aboriginal communities is just, like, pretty drastic. And to respect that and understand that maybe we don't want to impose that. Yeah.
Sure. There's a lot that you said, but I want to talk on a couple of them and maybe go further into this a bit. But you talked a bit about, like, so identity being a combination of your embodiment of who you are, but also of, like, your lived experiences. And I'm wondering if you could also talk about it in terms of sort of the historical context that we exist in, right? And so, sort of the question, like, I have a whole section here on sort of how our historical and social context sort of affects our ways of understanding about who we are and who we are in relation to processes of decolonization or indigenous struggle.
Yeah.
And, so I guess one of the questions I had around that is, I wonder if you can comment a bit on the organizations and groups you've been involved in terms of struggle and how they've sort of fit in historically into that sort of process of decolonization and indigenous solidarity.
Yeah. So like the activist groups I've been in, part of? Yeah, I mean, the one thing that comes to mind is with Common Cause, we had a we hosted a book tour. It was called Black Flame, and it was a, I haven't even read the whole book, but it's like a very in-depth history of of anarchism and syndicalism struggles throughout the world, and with some focus on decolonial movements elsewhere. And it didn't have much to do with... Well, I mean, I think just what I was getting at is, like, the parallels of decolonial movements, which I don't really know a lot about elsewhere. So I'm not sure what I was getting at. But the thing that I thought about Common Cause is that we really tried to have a focus on developing our internal politics and our self-education. And that was really something that was new to me. I mean, like, so much of the activism that I've been involved with historically and even present is about getting things done, and it's not about really, like, developing a common base of understanding to do that work. It's kind of like you come in from where you're at with your own understandings. Other people might share something. You probably share them some things just because you came together over the certain project, so it probably means you have some things in common, some ideas of what you want to do. But I think, like, the whole thing was, like, tactical unity or strategic and or ideological and tactical unity or whatever. I think that's important, like, that we do come together collectively if we're going to work together and develop this common understanding of what we're basing our actions on, whether it's values or principles or ideology or whatever. And I think that's, like, something that obviously I have found lacking, and it didn't work too well from my experience in Common Cause. We weren't really, really cohesive enough to really get that going well. And this is in Ottawa, where it was a smaller group. And I think they had more success in Hamilton and Toronto. But I think a lot of activism is too much about we have to do the next thing, and we don't take the time to reflect or build that common base of understanding. Or, if we do, it's often in these one-off workshops or conferences or whatever, which don't have the space for that ongoing building.
Yeah, I think that's a huge concern for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And why I think it's interesting that this sort of shift has taken place over the last while. Can you talk a bit about sort of maybe over the last 4 or 5 years what you've seen has been different about how people have engaged with either Indigenous struggles or with just processes of internal decolonization within their movements from what you've seen?
Yeah. I think one thing is just people are talking about it more and have that awareness and realize its importance. So I think there's a really good collective will to be working on this and trying to understand it more. Like I was saying, though, I don't get the sense that there is really this shared collective understanding of what we mean or what we're talking about it. And even, I was thinking, like, there's a discussion on, like, queering and decolonizing anti-oppression work, or anti-oppression workshops specifically, and looking at anti-oppression as though it's a buzzword and it's not really doing all that. But I think even decolonizing is another buzzword that we don't necessarily have this great understanding of what we're doing. And I think, again, like I was saying, everyone comes at it from this, like, their own perspective and their own experiences and their own learning that they've done, and it's all different. So I think having these opportunities to really have conversations about that is important, and that's something that I really think we need to do more of in our own group. And I can't really speak to what other people are doing, other than I know that I think people are taking it seriously, or at least it's on their agenda in some way or other.
What would you say, I mean, over the last 30 or 40 years, we've been sort of living in this historical context of, like, neoliberalism, and that's, it's really affected a lot of how people interact with each other, because it's just so dominant right now.
Yeah.
How do you think neoliberalism has affected, like, maybe not just radicals, but just people in general's ability to sort of engage in thinking around decolonization or around sort of alternatives to the current system and that kind of thing?
Yeah. The one kind of, like, aha moment I had, I was just, like, downtown one time and just, like, wandering around, and it just felt like, I don't know, I saw this one person, and it just made very clear to me that people, like, are in shock. Like, it's hard to function sometimes, and it's hard to be really coherent, as John Trudell likes to say, and clear about what's really going on, because there's just, like, so much going on all over, and it's, yeah. I think we have to deal with so much that it's hard to really be, I can't think of the word, but just maybe diligent with keeping a focus. And I think, like, I'm kind of like, I find it hard to really have an ongoing focus on building anything. It's like, because there is so much going on. I do media work, and I'm like, kind of like, I'll do an interview on one subject and then something on something else. And while they are connected, and while they do kind of like complement a building of a holistic understanding, they're still almost like, yeah, it's hard to bring everything together, I think. And it's kind of like, I don't want to say it's a cop-out, but just to, like, have one focus. You want to bring everything else into it, but at the same time, it's overwhelming. Yeah.
There's this professor at York University, Benita Lawrence, who's a Mi'kmaq professor, who wrote an article a while back, maybe 2005 or so, in which she talked about how radical communities need to put indigenous struggles at the center of their work, regardless of if they're anti-racist radicals or anti-capitalist or, you know, disabled activism, or, you know, all the homophobia, all these things, right? How would you respond to that, or what do you think of that concept that within any work on sort of settler colonial land, indigenous solidarity needs to have a central focus?
Yeah, I mean, to apply that, I think you have to look at where people are at and what they're struggling with. And the immediate things that they're dealing with don't necessarily afford everyone the opportunity to focus on centering indigenous struggles or centering decolonization. And I think that, like, that's just kind of what maybe I was getting at with the neoliberalism, just like this all-out assault on people's lives and people's communities, is that you have to deal with what's in your own life, and maybe that ends up sidelining what we should be centering. And there's different perspectives. Like, I know some people think that, like, what I've experienced is that I almost, like, put aside my own life or my own immediate concerns to do solidarity work. And I think I'm working at trying to see how they go together better. But it almost feels like it's doing separate work. It's kind of like, what do I have to do for my own life today, and what am I going to do in terms of activism for, well, Indigenous solidarity? And I think, and that's also what I was saying about, like, when people ask, like, if you're not, like, this full-time committed activist, what, where do you fit in? I think a lot of times people don't make the connections between their own life and the like, change the world work. And I think it's important to put those two together. And so it's like a question of how do you relate decolonization to all your different own struggles and your community struggles. Yeah.
I think actually you're sort of flowing really naturally into the section on relationships that I wanted to sort of touch on. I think it's really interesting that I think your answers actually bring up some really important points in terms of how we can talk about sort of relationships that help us engage in decolonization, but also that go outside of that traditional activist, full on invest everything, including your own mental and social health, and I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about sort of what type of relationships or processes or ways of interacting do you see as being important in terms of building long-term and sustained movements for decolonization?
Yeah, I think really having community spaces that are there on an ongoing basis that bring people together is really important. And it doesn't have to be bring people together to do the next action or to do the next whatever, or even to formally get taught about anything. But like I was saying before, like, communities are really, it's more like people have all these connections with other people, but do we really have functioning communities? So I think building those spaces, like Alan Sears talks about infrastructures of dissent, and do you know about that?
No.
Okay. Yeah, it's just the whole, like, what are the things that are actually infrastructure to building movements? Like, what are the physical spaces? What are the what kind of, like, resources, whether they're, like, learning resources or access to whatever. I don't, like, it's just the whole concept of, like, what are the building infrastructures that hold together and provide space for these movements to really grow and for people to be part of them, so we're not all fragmented. So I think that's a really key thing. And because I think if you have the space where people are connecting, you can build community around that. And it's kind of like, I know, instead of framing things about what we're against and building communities around what we're against, you kind of build a community, and I can't remember exactly, but it's like, you're focusing on the we, and what are our values, and what brings us together, and forming spaces around that. Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about, so the one thing I've been asking people that I think has been really interesting for me is, it came out of one of my own experiences sort of doing migrant justice organizing in Toronto, is that there are times where, you know, whether you want to or not, your work sometimes can be contradictory, right? So, for instance, when we were doing a lot of, like, anti-deportation work, you know, on one end, we're trying to build movements of solidarity with indigenous struggles and self-determination. And in the other respect, you know, we're also sort of like trying to beg the state to allow somebody to stay. And it causes this thing in which you say, are you then justifying the Canadian government's right to be able to determine who goes in and out of indigenous lands, right? And so we had to really grapple with those type of contradictions in our own work. I'm wondering if you can think of examples or stories of where you've had to either personally or collectively deal with particular contradictions or things that were uncomfortable in terms of your engagement in this type of Indigenous solidarity work.
The one I'm not really sure if I have a good answer for that. The one thing I'm thinking of is just like the amount of resources that get devoted to going to court, and where if someone's in court, like, so two things. One is this was based on some blockades that happened up just off the reserve for Rapid Lake, which is where Algonquins and Bear Lake are. And so one thing is that there were people, both people from Ottawa, I think from Montreal too, and also from the community that were charged. And in terms of solidarity support, we could mobilize, like, say, like 10 people to drive up 2 hours to Maniwaki to attend the court cases of people from Ottawa. But when people from the community would go, and if they had different dates, no one from Ottawa went up to support them. So that's one thing where it's like really kind of like supporting your friends, but not going broader than that. And the other thing that I like kind of like bugged me is that if we can get 10 people to go and sit in court all day, like making like say like a 10-hour commitment, but those same people won't put 10 hours into trying to organize what we're like trying to work on. So I don't think that's really answering a question, but it's just things that, those are experiences that we've had that I think point somewhere.
No, I think that actually does answer the question really fully. And I guess, so sort of picking up on that a bit, like, why do you think that is? That people are more sort of willing to sort of do the 10-hour trip? Do you think it's because they've built sort of that relationship with that friend? And so there's like, you know, like what we were talking about before, is that rather than be a whole bunch of either emergency actions or sort of dispersed networks of people, this is actually somebody they consider a family or friend, right? And that they've built a long-standing relationship with that.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why? Or is there something else that you think? Is there
I think that's part of it. I think it's also I gave a workshop on outreach and recruitment, and it just occurred to me when I was going over there about how to open up the thing, because I was doing it based on some marketing principles I learned about like entrepreneurship. And so the point I made in the workshop was that we could actually learn some things from business approaches, because even though it's not like we're trying to make a profit, but businesses, if they aren't making a profit, if they aren't achieving their goal, they stop doing what they're doing. Whereas I don't think we really challenge the way we do things or think through what we do. We just kind of do what we think is expected or what we've seen other people do. We don't think what's the most effective things we can do, ways we can spend our time, that kind of thing. So I think it's just like court support is just something you do, and it ends up taking way more resources than anything else we do, and it's not necessarily all that effective, I don't think. Like, does it help if you have 10 people sitting in the court rather than 3 or 4? So maybe that's an answer?
That's okay. Yeah. I'm just going to stop it.
Okay.
We only have one section left. So
okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah. Do you want me to stop this too?
No.
Or are we just going to keep going? Okay.
Okay, so the last section of questions are sort of questions that have that influenced me, or I was influenced by reading a lot of work by Leanne Simpson. Do you know Leanne Simpson?
Yeah.
So Leanne Simpson and Tag Alfred around this concept of resurgence.
Yeah.
And they talk a lot about how indigenous struggles aren't necessarily revolutionary struggles or reform struggles for reform, but this idea of this resurgence of ways of being outside of this colonial system. And it really resonated with me in terms of thinking also about sort of non-indigenous radicals and the way they're trying to create sort of these ways of being that are outside of sort of this logic of capitalism and colonialism, right? And so, without appropriating it, it's interesting to see some of the parallels between these concepts. And so, I've been going around asking people just questions related to this idea of resurgence. And so, the first question I've been asking is sort of like, we talk a lot about sort of what we call prefiguration, or sort of imagining this world that we want to create.
Can you stop for a sec?
Yeah.
I just want to comment on what you were saying about the resurgence and the. I think like seeing traditional indigenous cultures as like having things that are viable or like things to think about today. Benita Lawrence was doing a book launch and we hosted it here in Ottawa, and I think it was Bob Lovelace who was saying how like. Basically, like, they didn't have a wage-based society. So just, and that's back to imagination and back to, like, different ways of organizing society. If you can see that is a viable way of organizing, you don't all have to go and work for a wage to live. Like, there's different ways of organizing society, and they existed in the past, and they've kind of been stamped out, and I know like the residential schools in Common Cause, one of our members wrote an article about how residential schools was basically to take these Aboriginal, one aspect of what it's doing is to take this Aboriginal community and force it into the wage economy, so that there's not this alternative existing in Canadian society that non-Indigenous people can look at and say, wow, that's really different and maybe it's better than our society, but they just want to like not have that in existence anymore. And that also made me think of like just, I think there's stories of like settlers who like abandon the settler colony and go and live with Indigenous people when those two cultures were existing side by side and the Indigenous ones are still more intact, and they just saw it as maybe that's a better way to live, and I don't have allegiance to the state. And yeah, so I think like Aboriginal or Indigenous communities or ways of life really got stamped out because they were this alternative that
yeah,
could
No, you're actually answering the question right away,
okay.
Right, which is great. And I think I wonder if you could maybe expand a bit about sort of the danger in sort of either remembering things that either Indigenous folks have been doing and continue to do, you know, in the face of huge amounts of colonization or oppression, but also remembering non-Indigenous ways of being that have, always, you know, because they've always existed. So there's this, it's a really good book by David Graeber, where he talks about this idea of baseline communism, that in your house, you create a communism that exists within your house, sometimes even in your family, right?
Yeah.
In which the way you treat each other is way different from how you would treat each other, like treat strangers on the street. And he's saying that, like, these are ways in which we've preserved these ways of being, even while the dominant narrative is in the capitalist logic or colonial logic. And so the question I've sort of been asking folks is, do you see sort of some of the parallels between how over maybe the last 10, 15 years of organizing in radical communities, people have started to pick up on external ways of being that exists outside of capitalism, and they're organizing in ways that actually are very in sync with indigenous ways of being that are coming back into power through this process of resurgence?
Yeah. Along those lines, an Algonquin spiritual teacher was telling me how when he is passing on teachings to non-native people, how it's really like a way for them to reconnect with their own lost spiritual practices, because I guess they share some similarities. And there's a whole lot to say about cultural appropriation and stuff. But I think, like connecting with what was lost, with what was stamped out, in whatever ways that can be done, can be really powerful. And,
And I guess the last question I usually ask folks is, so a lot of people have suggested that instead of building something new, we're actually trying to reassert long-standing ways of engaging relationships. What do you think the role is of sort of taking these, you know, what we talked about before, these ideas and desires and principles that we sort of built our organizing around? What's the role in sort of taking those and actually pushing for these new relationships, these new ways of being?
What's the role? I'm not sure.
So, you know, we talked about ideas and desires and principles earlier.
Yeah.
And sort of coming back within this idea of resurgence, what is the role of those ideas and desires and principles in terms of this idea of resurgence of ways of being outside of the current logics that we're in?
Yeah, I think it's... Well, I think it's like a lot of people have these values that don't fit into capitalism or to neoliberal society or however you want to say our society is organized. And a lot of it is community, and we're really broken up. And I think what you were saying about like inside the home, as an example of how you can treat each other differently. I think if you have strong communities where you have good relationships with people, the stronger connections you have in an ongoing community, the more chance there is to bring back those values. Because otherwise there's not really a place for them if it's more like transactional relationships.
Do you have anything else you want to add that you were thinking of?
Yeah, I guess just I think I mentioned some of this. So, like, we're all kind of, like, coming in to learning about decolonization through different ways, have different learning experiences. So there's no, like, there's not necessarily a shared understanding. So I was thinking about the is it how individual responsibility it is to build your own understanding versus like a collective responsibility. Like, we're going to share our understandings and we're going to make, like, prioritize that. And then what that brought up to me was, thinking about accountability. And it's like, who are you accountable to? Because, like, you might not, I don't know, you might not have strong relationships with people that you should be accountable for, too. Or are you just, like, self-accountable that you have to be responsible to bring this up with the people that you're in relationship with? Because they're not going to hold you accountable for not doing it. So just some thoughts on that.
That's a good way to end it.
Okay. Well.